Welcome to Homeschool Companion, your source for information, motivation, and inspiration. If you're part of the homeschool community or simply interested in learning more about home-based education, stay tuned. Together, we'll examine the latest resources, learning styles, and teaching techniques. We'll speak with experts in the field to help you uncover every homeschool advantage. We'll also present suggestions on how to keep Christ in the curriculum as we explore fresh ways to teach and learn.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Richard Tooley, and with me here is Dr. Rose Gamblin, and we're talking today about how people learn. Pretty interesting subject. I can remember back when I was in school, the original concept was, especially in elementary school, was open up my head, pour knowledge in, and I got it. And then I was learned. So, yes. How have things transformed from there? When you think about the different learning theories, you know, we could probably go through the whole litany of different learning theories, and that would take up a lot of time. But if you could list, say, the two or three, well, even let's back up and talk about just the ideology behind learning. There are probably two different frames, the positivist frame and the constructivist frame, in which learning happens. So could you describe some of these things to us here a little bit?
Well, things that I've embraced, I really like Kohlberg's cycle of learning, which actually goes way back to Tao.
Yes.
Where you are exposed to something, and then human nature, we go, well, why do I have to learn that? Some of us say that right off the bat. Why do I have to learn that? And we can't see any value in it, we just set it aside. But then there's others of us that go, well, I just like to learn for the sake of learning. And so tell me what you want done and I'll do it. And then further in the cycle, okay, I've learned this now. How can I connect it and expand upon it? And what could I do different next time? And so it becomes the cycle, when it becomes into what we call format, where you're now incorporating other learning theories like multiple intelligence, that kind of thing. You know, pretty soon you're really fascinated about that child, how they like to learn, the modalities of learning, you know, our kinesthetic and our tactile and our audio. Those kinds of things seem to hang in there and resonate with an educator. And the multi-intelligence of Gardner. Gardner was a psychologist. He really wasn't.
Yeah, he wasn't an educator.
Yeah, he wasn't expecting that the educators would take it and run with it, but it just made sense. I remember back in the early 1990s doing seminars on multiple intelligence. You know, I just had read his stuff and I could relate it to certain students that I had, and with those stories and with that idea, I could do a seminar at a teacher's convention, and the teachers would just eat it up because it resonated with them too.
You know, one of the things I remember from way back, and I wonder if it still holds true, is that you can teach someone about 6% or 6 to 8% new knowledge. And that's about as much as a human can absorb at any given stage. So, for instance, when you go through first grade, you exponentially learn, but you have to build on prior knowledge. And so you can get 6 to 8% more, and then second grade has to repeat a lot of first grade, and you get 6 to 8% more all the way up until you graduate. I don't know if that's holding in the current theories now, but that used to be the idea, is that you could really only learn about 6 to 8%
Well,
more.
And that was when they basically did teacher-directed learning, where the teacher got up and the kids had slates or, you know, a tablet of paper, and then they wrote down what the teacher was telling them to write down. And that model started as young as, you know, in the first grade, before they had kindergarten. So the teacher would write the letter on the board, and the student would write the letter on the slate, and the teacher would write, you know, so they were copying. And we know that usually, there are exceptions to every rule. I want everyone to know that. When we're talking about learning, everybody learns in their own unique way. But overall, if a teacher's just telling you something, you're not going to remember more than 6%. So that 6% is a piece of data that has run true over time. So now we have a lot of other things that we know about learning, like left and right brain. That is something that we didn't understand before. You know, if someone was left-handed, in my day and age, we tried to make them be right-handed. We didn't understand that we were totally messing with how their brain worked and how they learned.
Yeah, there's some pretty fascinating things when you start talking about some of these things. You know, the idea of knowledge versus meaning. You know, we look at things, or did used to look at things, as we wanted to give people knowledge. We wanted to give people knowledge. And I suppose that's probably why one of the 6% things goes there. If you get knowledge, it lies dormant until you can actually use it, and then it becomes meaningful. You know, that's some of the old concepts of it. If I gave someone a horse pick, no one would know what it was unless they knew how to clean horse hoofs. Then suddenly a horse pick becomes meaningful. So we have to attach our knowledge to meaning, otherwise it doesn't have it. So this opens up, you know, when you start talking about it, there's two different ways of looking at knowledge, you know, at the learning process. Either you're constructing knowledge or constructing meaning, or you're uncovering meaning. You know, two different schools of thought go through that. I tend to be one who believes that knowledge and meaning is constructed. You know, we go through life and we create mental models or schema that we use to filter everything through, and then we build on those. And we build in the form of sound bites a lot of times. We get little pieces here, little pieces there to construct our worldview and to gain information, to gain knowledge, and to gain the method by which we learn. Each one of us do it somewhat differently. So when you started talking about left and right brain, you know, there's a book by Daniel Pink called Whole Brain Thinking. And,
yes.
And it was a very fascinating book. And they're taking these physicians, students out of Harvard, and instead of just continuing to teach them in the sciences, they're making them take courses in the arts, because the arts do some shaping of the brain. For instance, you talk about the Mozart effect. You know, people who listen to Mozart music, and it was specifically Mozart music, were actually doing better than students who weren't in the tests that were done. They call it the Mozart effect. So we have all of these different things that are coming out, and it leads into, okay, so if you are teaching a class now, how will you use this to increase the amount of learning that a student gets, the knowledge that they're going to get? How would you approach it in a classroom to make it practical?
People tend to teach the way that they were taught and the way they like to learn. So I think it's important that every teacher identify their multiple intelligence, identify if they're an audio, visual learner, because we don't want to fall in the trap of always trying to teach that way to the student who might need to be more hands-on. There are so many learning theories now that the most recent thing is called the holistic approach to teaching in, no, the holistic approach to technology-enhanced learning. So we've now added technology. You know, we understand that there are some kids that learn best when they're in front of a screen, even though it might not be the best physically for them because of the gamma rays and whatever. So with that background, state your question again.
If you were to design, yeah, I'll put it this way. If you were to design the ultimate classroom, the one that would actually exponentially increase the student's capacity in learning, given that you have a finite amount of time with these students in a day, what would you do? How would you set up the ultimate classroom? And let's bring it down to students, say, grades three or four, and then you can work all the way up to grade 8, because within that span, there's, I mean, they're learning differently, but the process of learning is the same way. I mean,
yes, and with the knowledge we have of Montessori and Dewey and some of these really progressive thinking, forward thinking educators, I like to go back to some of the things they did. I think my classroom would have learning stations all around the classroom. And in these learning stations, they would be coordinated with some of the things that the kids had to do independently apart from the learning station, like a worksheet or a project or something like that. But they would still have the excitement of going to the station and having a hands-on opportunity. Even with math, you could have the algebra tiles set up there for the more advanced student. And so they would always have movement built into every lesson. They would always have anticipation of, you know, at this point, then I will go and work in the learning stations. And they would have it would be very safe so that they could make mistakes and know that people weren't going to make fun of their mistakes, and that it would be very collaborative. So if there was something they didn't quite understand, they could ask the neighbor. Maybe that was even in a different learning station at the time. They could ask that neighbor, that other student, to help them, and they would know that that student wouldn't put them down either. Of course, I'm describing to you what I do because I think it's the best thing. At the same time, I always want to be open to incorporating new things. Every student would have their own laptop or Chromebook, but it wouldn't be the end all. It would just be another tool, and every tool that we could help them learn with, that's what I'd love to have available to them.
Well, we have to take a break now, and when we come back, we will continue on this journey of different learning theories and learning modalities and different ways of teaching to help children become what they can be, or all students become what they can be.
Michaels, and welcome to Heartbeat. In the movie The Soloist, Robert Downey Jr. portrays a journalist who reaches out to a homeless man who used to study cello at the Juilliard School of Music. The homeless man struggles with bouts of schizophrenia, but when he sits down to play the cello, his ability is beyond even the principal cellist of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Though inconvenient and often uncomfortable, the veil of prejudice falls from the eyes of Robert Downey's character, and he is able to see and learn in new ways. Is there someone today through whom you could learn the true meaning of having a relationship? Heartbeat is brought to you by the Salvation Army.
You've been listening to Homeschool Companion. You know, we'd love to hear from you. Be sure and like us on Facebook at Homeschool Companion, or partner with us. Send us a contribution or a show suggestion at P.O. Box 413, Smithsburg, Maryland, 21783, or call us at 301-824-3162.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Richard Tooley, and with me here is Dr. Rose Gamblin, and we're talking about learning and methods of helping children learn. And we've gone through a lot of different things, and recently we've just been describing what the ideal classroom setting might be. Now, you talked about having different learning stations, and you've talked about, now at the end of that, you were talking about the Chromebook. So how does technology impact what you do now? I mean, back in my day, and I go way back, we had the old desks with the wooden runners on them, so it made sure you couldn't move your desk, and your front of your desk was the seat back of the person in front of you, and so on and so forth, all the way up to the front. Matter of fact, some of my original ones had the little inkwell in the side of them.
We're definitely giving away our age, because both of us actually experienced the desks with the runners and the rows.
So it goes way back, and then they moved to desks that you can actually move around, but still, the desks were all lined up in rows facing the front. Now you're talking about something different, where you really don't have desks necessarily all lined up in rows. You have desks that are in pods, you move your desks around into different formations, and the student's time at the desk is not where they spend most of it.
Right, it's more of a area to keep your stuff. It's a landing place. We talk more in terms of, you know, anchor points, anchor assignments, anchor points. A desk is an anchor point, and a worksheet may be considered an anchor assignment, because we now know the value of learning, that if a child can move, and all of these things have just come into being in recent times. You know, we've made students sit for way too long, and now we know that just a little walk around the room helps that learning stick in their mind.
That's interesting, because what you're talking about here now is attaching physical to mental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was part of one of Gardner's learning theories, you know, the
yes.
kinesthetic learning, and where actually moving and touching and using all of your senses to learn helped you enhance your learning ability.
And we've talked about it for a long time, but teachers have not walked the talk, and whole school districts haven't walked the talk, because they've taken out recess, and so now they've even limited the movement that the child has.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Some of the research that I've done showed that there are schools, especially the smaller schools where they have different things like recess, etc., they spend less time on the core subjects but do better on the tests.
Yes, less is more. So how do we learn? How does your brain learn? When you're thinking about your thinking, we call it metacognition. When you're thinking about your thinking, what resonates with you? How much, when we talk about the multiple intelligence, and, you know, do we really value that introspective intelligence, where a child is, you know, they like to just think about their thinking, and you don't see it expressed so much, and so you might think they're not learning, but they really are. They're thinking about their thinking.
Yeah, we did experience that. We've seen it in some of our students where you would take a student, you'd think, there goes a brick. And just a brick. And then, bang, here comes a question out of the blue that is completely floors you, because it is so incredibly insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to reassess what you think of that. You know, that brings up one of the things I always tried to practice was never to pigeonhole a person.
Right.
You know, you never wanted to be able to, you never wanted to say that person's not going to make it, that person's going to make it. And that's the beauty, though, too, of recognizing multiple intelligences and recognizing diversity in the classroom, you know, recognizing different learning styles, all of those things, and teaching to the variability of the students. That's an important part of it, because each student then becomes a unique person.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that we see in classrooms is that there is a certain lockstep process needed to have happen, and that's hard to deal with. So,
mm-hmm.
But is that counterintuitive to different learning styles of a student?
I think if a teacher really values that child, and I have thought about I do a lot of metacognition. I think about my thinking. I think about my pedagogy. Every student is a new subject to learn for me as a teacher. One experiment that I did, I thought, you know, I really do think some of these children are academically brilliant. Some of the children have some challenges. But I wonder what they think I think of them. And so a time came and I said, okay, how many of you think I think you're smart? And do you know the kids that I didn't think were as smart academically, you know, smart? They're smart in other ways. They raised their hands first, and the kids that I think are really, you know, their test scores are really high and they just love to learn for the sake of learning, they were a little slower. in raising their hand, but they raise their hand too. And of course, you know, you could only ask this question if you had spent some time with the group. You know, like in this case, I'd spent almost 4 years with the majority of these students. So we had this relationship where, you know, we could raise our hands at that kind of question and not feel like we were bragging or anything. But I just thought it was interesting that the students that I really thought had the biggest challenges raised their hands first.
You know, that is a testament to the Pygmalion effect. You know, we've talked about Pygmalion yes. effect before, and there is a tendency to have that happen. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, that person's dumb, and so they show up dumb. And it has to do, really, with your body language and your nonverbal communication to that child.
Right, and I wanted to make sure, I think maybe I've overcompensated. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't sinking into the Pygmalion effect. I mean, we've talked about this Pygmalion effect a lot on this show. I hope everybody understands the Pygmalion effect because it can impact every relationship that you have, you think of them.
Yeah, it is, of all of the different things that we have going on, it is one of the most crucial things to understand. It will happen to your child in your classroom if the teacher thinks that child's not going to make it. That child now is encumbered. Mm-hmm. With a lot, and the child may not even know the teacher doesn't think he's going to make it overtly.
Well, and this brings up another area that has not been researched. It's in my own thinking, but I know that there was research done with infants, and the mirror neurons in the brain that were picking up what the mother thought of them or felt about them. You know, there was a communication that they can't fully understand. And I think there's another type of communication between human beings that we don't fully understand yet. But it would make sense then in light of the Pygmalion effect that if you can't fake it. In other words, that you have to love that student. You have to believe that student has gifts to give mankind, that God placed in them. And it doesn't matter if this student has Asperger's syndrome, is autistic, is Down syndrome, mental retardation. It doesn't matter. They're on this planet for a reason. And whatever God has given them in their thinking, and He's placed them in your circle, you have to develop them to their fullest potential. That's part of what God has placed you as a teacher to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because that is a philosophical difference between the concept that would be brought in by evolution, for example, where we are mere organisms which have zero value, as opposed to being created by God as unique individuals and unique people. And it creates problems for the teacher in the classroom, but it also creates opportunities. Well, we're going to have to come back to that topic at a later date because we have run out of time, and so I have one thing left to say. That is, God bless.
You have been listening to Homeschool Companion, a production of MRG Media. Be sure to join us on Facebook. Just type in the name Homeschool Companion. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.